Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members
Teresa, Linda, and Annie,
are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature, or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
This is the sequel to Bill Logan's first interview, and here we're introducing the topic of pollarding, which he is an absolute expert in. Settle in and listen up. Urban Arborist is your business in Brooklyn?
Yes.
And you started the book, Sproutlands, talking about doing coppicing?
Pollarding. We were called on to pollard trees at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Can you define pollard for us?
That led to a whole thing. So give the definition of both of those.
There are two ancient ways of taking care of trees. And when I was first asked to do it by these people who had designed really fine, probably I think the best American landscape design firm, Olin Partners, they wanted to use both hedging, which would not really coppicing, but making heading cuts so they would sprout again on lindens, and pollarding, which is to cut back stems not to a node where we usually would so that they would grow naturally out of whatever branch was remaining, but cut them back to cause them to sprout. And that was done up until the 18th century around the world as a way to get wood for all the various purposes that people needed wood, and also to get leaves. So sometimes it was done in order to get leaves to use as a fodder for your animals. So many different reasons. And coppicing was doing the same thing, but cutting all the way to the ground. And coppicing is fine. The only thing is, if you have animals in the pasture and you coppice, you got to keep the animals out of the pasture for a while, or you got no coppice because they'll eat it back. So both were done. And when I got interested in these, because I had to do it for this job, and, you know, I said, I'd done this, yeah. And I had, because, you know, I teach in Europe Botanical Garden, so I've taught pruning there for 25 years. And we have done experimental pollarding there and things. But I figured, you know, this is going to be on Fifth Avenue. We'd better know what we're doing. So we went out to try and find out about it, and I found out that it was very difficult to find out about it because not many people, at least in this country, knew about it anymore. But then as I was doing it, I thought, well, this is all very well and good. I started to learn how to do it and make it look very beautiful. But I thought, well, this is going to make the trees live a very short time. And what was the motive for writing the book was when I found out that not only did it not make the trees live a short time, but it typically made them live much longer than if they had not been cut. And they put the Western Bird Arboretum in England where it is, because there is a 2,000-year-old coppiced linden there. It's been cut on a 20-year cycle for 2,000 years, and it's still there. And many of the oldest trees now alive in Europe, all the way down into Eastern Europe, are trees that were either still are or once were pollarded or coppiced. So it's interesting that it's different than what I expected, and that's what led me to start looking into all that I looked into in that book.
So where can I go to see these pollarded trees in New York City if I'm in New York?
Right in front of the Metropolitan Museum.
Yeah, I thought that's where they were.
You've
beautiful.
Seen
yeah,
them.
I have. I just didn't know who the creator of them was, who the artist was. That's excellent.
Well, it was Olin who designed it brilliantly, and then we still do it, and it's one of our crew's favorite things to do every spring is to go in there and take them
and
back.
I understand that it was done for sustenance reasons in the past, but why did he want to pollard these trees? I'm just kind of understanding the concept.
Well, it became ornamental, particularly in Southern Europe. And if you want, I mean, if you become a pollard geek, as I've been accused of being,
there are pollard geeks.
There are indeed. And if you become one, you will travel about looking for them. And particularly in Southern Europe, you will find lots and lots of them. And people who could do it in the country then realized, hey, this isn't so bad in the city because it allows me to take a tree that would normally get very large and keep it at a better size where we can use it without it doing damage or without it being damaged by people so much. So by kind of controlling it a little bit, we can do this. And also, you know, you would find people who learn to do the most astounding things with this. And in Europe, it's still something that is widely practiced. So particularly the Basques, who will never change what they do for anybody, have made the most astounding, both kind of things you would expect in ornamental pall arts, but also pall arts that they've specifically shaped so that the wood will grow in patterns that is good for building ships.
Mm. We were talking about that. Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
And then they also will do the nose. There's one in the industrial harbor of Pasaya, one of my favorite kind of single alleys of trees in the whole world, is a group of London planes along the edge of this sidewalk, beyond which is a fence and then all the big ships. And they did it by pollarding and then letting certain stems grow back and suppressing others. And as those stems grew into one each other, they wound them together. And now they have about 500 yards of this kind of waving linear grove. It's just amazing. And without like blocking the view of the harbor, it gives you something to look at that almost makes you forget you're looking at an industrial harbor.
So it doesn't just control it vertically. It keeps the root growth manageable for urban situations.
Yes, and that's one of the things we're hoping, at some point we hope to be able to study and prove this. It's been proven in different situations. Ingvild Ostad, who's the great student of these trees in Western Norway, proved it in Western Norway, that one of the reasons that they have, you know, they would do pollarding mainly in order to get fodder for their animals. So they used fodder, they called it tree hay, was the fodder they got from the trees, and then they would cut grass hay. But apparently she discovered that when in areas where the tree hay had been cut, the grass grew better. And they started to study why that was. They thought, well, it's got more light. But then they realized that the roots were retrenching underground when the tree was pollarded, and that created organic matter, which helped the grass to grow.
Okay.
So that's a place where they've seen that actually working. And we see it in that we are not seeing it, partly because we've done a very good thing in the way those trees were planted there. We haven't compacted the soils at all, thanks to these wonderful things called silva cells, which allow us not to compact the soils. But we haven't seen any sign of lifting sidewalks, and we think that with pollards, you'll be able to go a very much longer time without having such problems.
And how old is this planting now?
About a decade. So, you know, it's a little early, but to see it anyway.
Well,
but we suspect that it's not going to, that we could probably prove it. And if we ever get the, if I ever have the time, I would try and prove that.
In your spare time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But the tree hay is almost like, it's almost like you're farming the tree, right? I mean, if that's what they were using that for fodder. It's almost like they're, instead of having a pasture, they're using a tree for the. It's really kind of interesting. And then it turned into an art form after that, which is kind of really fascinating that it evolved that way.
Well, the first we heard of tree hay was from the Stone Barn Center in Tarrytown, who referred to you as their guru. And that you're where they got the idea for that, and they're doing that with their livestock.
Yes.
Yeah. And it is thriving, apparently.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
They're loving it.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of experimentation, but based on some of your work, definitely.
Yeah, and it can, you know, it definitely, definitely, definitely can be done. But it's interesting that even the farmers, shockingly enough, in doing this book, I met two old men who had, within the last, well, one of them 2 years in the last year, had retired in their 80s. And the guy, Grinda, Lars Grinda, at Grinda Farm in Western Norway, his work was just gorgeous. I mean, I have pictures of what he was pollarding for fodder going down towards the Sonja Fjord. And it's one of the most beautiful plantations of trees I've ever seen. Because when you do this, you kind of think, you know, doing it in a way that is kind of like modernist architecture, doing it in a way that grows back well, also turns out to be very beautiful, and you want it to grow back well because you want the fodder. but you also end up learning how to work with the tree in order to produce these things.
And form follows function.
So yeah.
It's inevitably, tools are one of the beautiful, most beautiful things there are.
But it also seems like it's the art form where you have to have the most patience because it takes a while for that tree to grow back and you have to kind of understand how it's going to grow back.
Right? Yeah, and you get old and you have to pass it on.
Yeah.
That's what in the old days.
And who figured this out?
Who figured it out?
In the first place, yeah. I mean, there's certain things that you don't cut for 5 years and others for 3 years or whatever, depending on the purpose.
Yeah, and you kind of have to learn that by trial and error. Some people who leave things go for too long have a problem or try to cut something they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Like, you can pollard maples, but generally speaking, they aren't as happy about it as a lot of other species are. And there are other species that will not. And of course, most conifers will not resprout. So yeah, it varies with it. But you know, once you do it, you have to be willing to pass it on. A young guy I spoke to in Japan had it passed to him by his father, and he was a charcoal maker. Oh. And he was restarting the idea of being able to make charcoal from coppiced oak, which had been the mainstay of Japanese culture for several thousand years. But the coolest thing about Lars Grinde and also this other guy, they didn't know each other from Adam, this Basque guy down in Laiza. The Basque guy was a shepherd, and Lars Grinde, all kinds of animals, a mixed farm. They're both very old, and I interviewed them sitting in their houses. And I said to both of them more or less the same thing, which is why, you know, you must be very glad you had to get up early. You had to work so hard. I've seen a video of Lars and a partner of his cutting, and it was just hard, hard work. So I said to both of them, you must be glad not to have to do that anymore. And they both looked at me like I'd gone out of my head. And they said virtually the same thing. They said, no, you're wrong. If I had the strength, I'd be there right now.
So it was their calling.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
He said that's what Pachi Bariola in Laiza said. He said, it suited me. This was the work I loved. I would be there now if I could.
So when you talk about charcoal, I start thinking about, I know in Columbia County that they found these kind of areas where they've done burning and charcoal from, you know, maybe hundreds of years ago. And is that the same thing that we're talking about? Do you think those trees were pollarded and they were oak trees? Is that the same type of thing we're talking about or something different?
Not necessarily. It's the same principle. It's making charcoal. The thing about doing it with coppicing is you can do it again and again and again and again.
So it's kind of a renewable resource, in other words.
Right. Yeah. And you leave the roots in the ground, so you don't have to grow an entire new tree. They grow back much faster, and you can cut them on an 8, 10, 12, 20-year cycle and get different sizes of wood and do that basically perennially. There's a 1,000-year-old coppice forest in England that has never gone out of cycle.
And it's not the same thing as espalying trees, right? Or is it the same kind of thing?
Only in that it's a fairly hands-on, you know, it's really dramatic pruning.
So you wouldn't do pollarded apple trees, for instance, then?
No, because you wouldn't get, you know, with apple trees, they will bear on short shoots. And you want those shoots to develop, and they will last a long time, sometimes 8, 10, 12 years. As it happens, sometimes, you know, when a branch becomes non-productive, you may remove it and see if something else is coming up in its place, but you won't do it in the programmatic way that you would for, because it's the wood you want to harvest or the leaves you want to harvest when you're doing coppicing or pollarding.
So do you have a good feeling about this being passed on? It feels like this kind of almost lost art, and some of these folks are leaving us. I mean, is it being passed on to new generations now?
Well, it's an interesting question. It may or may not be. Certainly in Japan, it's beginning to be, because Japanese culture was so deeply based upon this kind of cutting that there's big movements to kind of restart it, and people like the fella Mistrono are doing it. Elsewhere, I think there are efforts, but I'm not sure where they'll go, because we don't use wood in the same way that we used to. Though maybe we will again. I mean, in Rensselaerville, I'm starting to. You know, I have all my ash trees that have died. I've cut them all into little bits, and We have efficient stoves now, and we can do a lot with wood. So maybe so, but I guess the thing that was most important to me in it, in studying all this, was to see that it's not true that human beings always destroy the things that they are related to in the world around them. For not only hundreds, but thousands of years, people around the world were able to sustain their woodlands in a way that's beyond sustainable. Yeah. They lived together. The people were as important as the trees and vice versa, and they gave a lot to each other. It's interesting that trees live a longer time when they're cut this way properly. So in a way, the trees got a benefit out of it too.
Hmm. Okay, ripped from the headlines. We're going to talk about the sycamore in England, and that is going to come back from...
God willing, it will sprout. Well, it's beyond coppicing. When you cut something that big, you're whacking it.
Poverty. You probably have to give a little background for people who don't know what you're talking about, Jean.
Okay. Hadrian's Wall in England, built by the Romans, has a sycamore growing at a gap in it that has become very famous scenically, and it was in the Robin Hood movie and all kinds of stuff like that. But some fool came along and cut the whole thing down and did a lovely job, by the way, very professional. Just cut the thing down in the middle of the night one night, and of course the whole world's gone bonkers because it's a historical thing. I guess it's a couple hundred years old.
I have no idea. They grow very fast.
I think they said it was maybe mid-1800s that it was planted.
Yeah, well then it's not that old for
a
sycamore.
For a sycamore. Yeah. So now they're all in a tizzy, but now the good news has come that it may sprout from the trunk, and that may have done the tree a favor.
Well, so it is coppicing, but no one would coppice intentionally a plant that large, because the larger the stem, the less likely it will come back, with a couple of exceptions. One of the reasons that there is that 2,000-year-old linden is that lindens have an organ at the base of the tree called a lignotuber, and the lignotuber can sprout for the entire life of the tree. So, but most trees, temperate trees anyway, a lot of trees in tropical places have it, but not very many temperate ones. Sycamore, as far as I know, does not have a lignotuber, but it is a really good sprouter. So that, and black locust too, you know, like you can see a big old black locust, and it'll sprout from everywhere. It'll sprout from the roots, it'll sprout from the trunk, it'll sprout from everywhere. So sycamore's kind of like that, so there's a reasonable chance that it will, and that's great. And in a way, it has rejuvenated it, but at, I think, more risk than should have been taken. Because it might not come back.
I don't think that was the plan.
Yeah, no, somebody did something. There's just so much meanness associated with trees and plants because, in a sense, they're defenseless, except for the fact that it's really hard to get rid of them. Somebody wanted to get
to
that out of there,
of the
and all they got to do now is wait for 200 to 300 years, and they'll have the same thing back. I had the great good fortune to ride around the Somerset Levels with one of the great living tree people, Neville Fay. And we were looking, it was just after a flood. We were basically the first people to get into the levels after the flood. And we were looking at trees that had once been 90 or 100 feet tall. And they had died all the way back down to the very base almost. But there were new sprouts, and those new sprouts were putting out their own roots, so the likelihood is that in another 200 or 300 years, they would be up there at 90 feet again, and that's just amazing that trees can do that.
Incredibly resilient.
They're smarter than we are, too.
Yes, they are smarter. Yeah, in some ways. There's some really great ones if you have a chance to go back to the hike preserve.
Yeah, tell us.
On
tell
we
us
used
about
to call
to
Loop 3, and it's changed its name now. It's called the Creek Trail. Back in the Partridge Path area, there's a creek, and along that creek are three or four utterly mad trees. I mean, one is a hemlock that sprouted, you know, it wanted to get some light, so it was out over the creek on a rock. But, of course, you can't put any roots out there, so it sent its roots back until they got at, and meantime, in, you know, 30 or 40 years later, most of the rock it was standing on has collapsed into the stream. So it's now cantilevered over the stream. And there's also a willow there that one of two streams cracked and fell. It's still partly attached right over the stream to the other side. And of course, it's now got seven or eight willows all growing up from the fallen trunk. But a couple of them at the very end that have reached the other side of the creek are putting out their own roots. So that's a plant which, you know, it's basically... move downstream.
Mini forest.
Yeah.
Now you make me want to go back to the hike preserve in Rensselaerville, which is a beautiful place anyway, but with these crazy trees, which I don't think I saw the first time I was there.
You kind of have to look.
Yeah.
But and it's also at the very kind of farthest trail. But it's well worth going along that creek, just because also in the summer it's beautiful and it's cool and it's a good place.
Well, and it's that example you're talking about of the resilience of trees, that they just keep coming back, which is a good thing since we're all just destroyers of trees, right?
That was what was fascinating to me about Sproutlands, was looking at all these cultures that did not destroy trees. Right. They weren't stupid. And if we destroy the trees, our lives are over. So let's figure out a way to do this right. And they did. And it's not like they felt good about themselves every time they did it, but they were kind of doing the right thing.
Right.
And I think over time, it's something that people had an affection for.
So there was a community between the trees and the people.
I would say so.
How does one become a pollard geek?
You can first of all go and visit them a lot, which is a lot of fun, which means you have to travel around. There's a fair number in the western United States. San Francisco Bay Area has a bunch. And there are in other places too, but Europe is where you'll see a lot of them. And you can even see them. There's a great grove in Shanghai. I've only seen pictures of it, of London Plains that were pollarded in the 40s, and they're just gorgeous. Mm. So you can see them all over the map. And then, you know, it helps to see a lot of them to begin to think about doing it, because it's not that hard, but it's not as easy as it looks. The main thing is, you know, because we're also addicted to seeing pictures and making things look like the picture. One of the first thing we realized when we started doing this was, if we make it look like the picture right away, we will kill it.
Right.
So we realize you have to go a little bit at a time and see how the tree responds. And it really is entering into pruning. It's really a great way to enter into a conversation with a tree, because a tree will tell you, yeah, that's okay. Okay, we'll go this way. That's fine. Or it'll say, oh, what are you doing? And won't sprout back. Or we'll say, you shouldn't have cut this one inside these two. I don't get any light. What's the hell's the use of this now? I'm going to drop it.
And so it takes a while for its response, right? It doesn't happen immediately, I assume, right?
Yeah, so you have to have
patience.
And the work was generational, you know?
Yeah.
You always found the next generation that would be doing it. And in the days when people lived close to the same place, I mean, in the Grinda farm where Lars Grinda worked, said, you must have been on this farm a long time, because I knew the farm had been there a long time. And he said, oh, my grandfather was the first one. But on the traditional farms in Norway, you take the last name of the farm when you move there. Mm. So his name was Grinda because he farmed Grinda Farm. And Grinda Farm had been farmed since the Bronze Age. Mm. So they've been passing on this way of doing things since, I don't know, 2000 BC.
Japan does the same thing, where the people name themselves after the farm?
Actually, there was the Meiji government that did that. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They wanted to be able to tax them. So they needed to give everybody last names. But it was interesting that they would take names that said, located them in the field, you know, like Tanaka, in the field, in the middle of the field.
Yeah.
Many, many of those traditional Japanese surnames are names that say where they lived in the land. Or sometimes we say what people did on the land.
Yeah.
Which
Fieldstone
is really
or
cool.
Smith or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we want to start a pollarded area in a park, we have to find some young people, Gene. We're not going to be able to do it ourselves.
Well, not only that, we have to find young people that will listen to us.
Right, which I don't think that's going to happen, but still.
You never know. Yeah, it might very well. And, you know, you could find, like when I went and worked with those young folks at Stone Barns, God, they were right on top of it. We can do this and we can do that. And, well, let's try this and why not? So it's good, and I'm now teaching. There's a new landscape architecture program at Pratt in Brooklyn, and they asked me to teach, and I said, I am not a landscape architect. And they said, we know. That's why
point.
We want you to teach. So I'm teaching plants and soils there, but it's astounding to see how eager these students are to learn about the world around
them.
So
there's an apprentice base available.
Yeah.
So not to put words in your mouth, but we usually ask the question of our guess, what gives you hope when you're out there looking at pollarding and doing your teaching and everything else? What gives you hope in the world?
Well, I guess in part the fact that there are, and I've taught pruning at New York Botanical Garden for several decades now, not quite three, but more than two. And it is so wonderful to see the variety of people. of all ages. Some are professionals, some who just have their own garden, some are just interested, who get out there. And the moment they get over the fear that they're going to do something wrong, it's like they've discovered a new world. And it's true that, you know, the relationship, the how much people thrive on the relationship between us and the world around us when they enter into taking care of, or sometimes just observing. Birders get it just by seeing the birds, but coming into relationship with the world that we didn't manufacture seems that, when I see that, it just makes me feel like there really is a hope, no matter what happens, what disasters we create as political entities, that as human beings related to the world around us, there's a lot that we can recover and a lot that we can build that really can't be taken away.
That is a great way to end, I think. I think that's a wonderful note of hope. Thank you so much for joining us today, Phil.
My
pleasure. Really appreciate it.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank
Sandra Powers
and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.